Welcome back to part two of Climate Emergency Manchester. This is our January podcast. We are gearing up for another year of exciting scrutiny of the council. So we're going to look at the CE UK Climate Emergency UK scorecards, which were published in November, I think. And this was the second round of scorecards that they have done. Climate Emergency UK is a small organisation operating since about 2019 to hold local government to account. Their scorecards use publicly available data and freedom of information requests to rate councils against criteria that they make publicly available. In 2021, the first round of scorecards assessed plans for climate action. They rated Manchester City Council as the top single-tier council in the country. They scored 87% against an average of 50%. I then wrote a snarky blog post.
And look what that led to. Look where that got
look
you.
Look where we are now. Basically, I sort of said, very good, you've got to the point of asking them about their plans when half or nearly half of the carbon budget is already gone. Welcome to the world of scrutiny, but maybe catch up a little bit. So they did. They invited us onto their advisory group to review the development of the second round of scorecards, and that was to assess progress against climate plans, to actually focus on their climate action. The results dropped in November 2023, and it seems that MCC's crown has been snatched.
They have also dropped quite some way.
They not snatched by one council, but snatched by 27 other councils. So yeah, Manchester came in as 28th. Do you have a list of councils that were in front of us? I do, but
I've got that in front of us.
Do you want to run through it?
Should we start with the top performing and then go down, or we want to go down? Like,
before that, we should say that no council is performing well. So top is relative, and I think this is quite good. So there are 27 that are better, but by no means are they doing well across everything.
Yeah, there was nothing like an 87% score at all. So no council in the country is doing enough on climate action.
But there are some that are doing better than Manchester, and they are.
Yeah, well, I won't go through every London borough, but pretty much every London borough seems to be, apart from Newham and Wandsworth, seem to be above
your home
them.
Borough.
I know, yeah, my home borough is actually performing worse than Manchester, which is a bit disappointing because they do say a lot about climate change, Newham. So I'm a little bit disappointed. Oh, Sutton, but just below Manchester as well. So not quite. Brighton are above. Cornwall. Big up Cornwall for that. Leeds. I bet they're a bit bitter about that. Glasgow, Aberdeen, Bristol. I bet they're a bit bitter about that as well. Bath and Somerset, Edinburgh. But top is Westminster City Council.
Basically, if you're a London borough or you're in Scotland or you're Bristol, you're doing better than Manchester. Leeds is the one that will have peeved them because they can't explain it away as having, you know, London borough or, you know, Transport for London things around that, and they can't explain it. Well, the Scottish
fellow
government.
Fellow Northern City.
It should, and they will think that they're better than...
Bitter rival.
Bitter, yeah. Leeds seems to have done much better on planning and land use, much better on biodiversity, and much better on governance and finance.
And so all of these different categories of questions that CE UK would have asked councils to complete or would have looked at their websites and tried to glean certain data on, we scored highest on collaboration and engagement.
The fuzzy stuff.
88%, which, is high. So that again speaks to where Manchester did really well on the last round of scorecards, having smart targets, updating plans, talking about them in scrutiny committees, having partnerships. But they lost points, I think, on not having a council motion to ban high carbon advertising and sponsorship, which is something we've mentioned once or twice in the last year. So interesting on that one.
We've got some negative scores as well. We've got some penalty marks, interestingly, on transport as well. I quite like this innovation on this round of scorecards. It wasn't in the last time because it shows it isn't just a case of council's not doing anything. Some are doing things which are actively detrimental. So in our case, investing in the airport and our air pollution is terrible. So I'm really glad that was marked as penalty marks. I think it's a good thing. It shows that the CUK exercise, compared to some of the other accolades, isn't just about trying to get councils to slap each other on the back with the penalty marks.
I think it also shows where there's room for improvement, because, you know, there's every section's got tens of questions in it. So I guess it's very, very specific about where there is room for improvement or where they can, you know, reduce the possibility of penalty marks, you know, when it comes to air quality. Or, you know, I can't see Manchester Airport or Manchester City Council ever divesting from the airport, because it brings in £40 million a year when it's running at sort of decent capacity and dividends. That's something I don't think this council will give up, because it's keeping the council afloat and not handing in bankruptcy notices to the central government. So
that is essentially the reason that we are not.
Yeah. And they'll say it's funding adult social services and children's services at the levels that they currently have, which probably is true, because they would obviously cut that.
I mean, it's the classic situation we are in so many different ways. This is where we need to get to be net zero. What's the main thing that's stopping that? We need money to fund social care and...
It's the trade-offs.
It's always money. It always comes down to money.
But what I quite like about the penalty marks in terms of recognising is whatever else you do, if you're still doing this, you're never going to score entirely highly.
Yeah. And there will be a third round of scorecards,
ooh,
I think.
That's good. What are they going to use the same?
I don't know.
This is not by no means perfect, and I have questions about what a difference it's actually going to make. But just looked at as an exercise, I think this was a big improvement over the one that you got snarky about.
Yes. And I would say and I think they would agree that it is imperfect, because what it doesn't do, you're trying to say, what is a common set of metrics that we can compare councils in London, Scotland, and all around the country, urban and rural, all the different types of councils, combined authorities versus single tier councils like Manchester? How can we set up questions that work for all of them? What that doesn't do is go into Manchester's smart targets and say, hang on, you've burnt through 63% of your carbon budget. You are clearly not acting fast enough. So it was very different to surface that information in a way that could be benchmarked across all of the different councils. But what it does do, I think, as you said, Adam, is that list of things you could work on. If you know that there's going to be a third round of scorecards at some point in the relatively near future, our carbon budget will probably be gone by the time a third scorecards would be published. But it does give you a clear look at, so looking at transport as an example, you know, if we start setting up school streets around the city, if we introduce a workplace parking levy, if we institute a properly working clean air zone or ULEZ, ultra low emission zone, if we increase bus ridership, and if we reduce air pollution, we'll score more highly. Those are the clear areas that we could start to work on.
Also, yeah, public expansion of a public network of electric vehicle charging points. You know, there are some clear things that, you know, you could say, well, these are things, work on these, or it's part of your work plan going forward.
It operates as quite a nice primer into like what is within a council's power. You know, sometimes it might help cut through some of those discussions that we sometimes hear about, oh, but what can we do, little old us? Like, this is give or take the things that they could do and that are within their power. So you could use it as a bit of a checklist and somebody who is coming to this new, it's first time for everybody coming to council's climate action, this would help them understand the things that a council can do and those levers that they can pull.
And increasingly, either at a Manchester or Greater Manchester level, these are things which are in their accountability. They have the power here. They're not dependent, although possibly for money, there's no one stopping them getting on board
exactly.
with this. In the case of air pollution, the government saying, get on with it, you've already missed the deadline.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a thorn in Mayor Burnham's side, isn't yes. it?
But not just Mayor Burnham. It's not just Andy Burnham's accountability. And too often we let individual councils off the hook because they will say Clean Air Zone was a Greater Manchester Combined Authority project, but it was signed off by all of the individual councils and none of them have made changes to it, or if they have suggested a better way of doing it, they've not done so publicly.
No, let him take the heat for it.
Oh, yeah, you can see that there's mass. Yeah, just kick it, punt it to the combined authority because, you know, Manchester didn't say, all right, voluntarily, we'll create a city centre clean air zone.
But they did say they could go further. When they signed off the clean air zone, they said, if they're, to all the critics, we can choose to take this further if we want to. And they didn't. What I'd also flag, we've talked about how the council describes itself. And there was another organisation that reviewed Manchester's environmental credentials, CDP. Adam, do you know a little bit about CDP? Do you want to give a...
So it was formerly known as the Carbon Disclosure Project. So it sort of has two parallel streams of work. One's company reporting, and the other one's city level, city and state level reporting. So I think they essentially do it, predecessor to CEUK. You ask questions, you get answers back, you score them, you rank. And they've been doing that for quite a long time now, I think in excess of 10 years, probably more than that. Started off with companies, and it started off as an investor thing. So investors looking at which companies they should invest their money if you want to put capital. So it's very much a model of a slow transition away from companies that aren't performing through to companies that are doing better things. And again, a way of accounting and measure and sort of measuring for investors to actually understand that. I guess the city's one's a bit of a, I don't know where it came from, but I'm presuming there was an interest at some level to sort of look at how cities are doing. But you can get into their data portal and you can ask some questions. So, yeah, we can go into that in a bit more detail for what happened to Manchester. So Manchester submits it and Greater Manchester as a city region also submits to it.
So we can add that to the very long to-do list of things we would like to find time to do, to go in and scrutinise the CDP data for Manchester, because no one else is going to.
And the question is, why did we hear from the council about the CDP data? Why did that feature in their comms, whereas our 28th place didn't feature in their comms?
So the newsworthy thing that the council was talking about was the fact that they were given an A grade by CDP, and it got mentioned in the scrutiny committee. It got, I think I saw it in either an email or on their website. In the same way that they talked about the previous round of scorecards from CEUK, when they became top of the leaderboard, they shouted about that too. But they didn't talk about the second round of scorecards and the fact that they got 28th place. And I find that a real problem if you're not willing to be honest about these sorts of things and platform that information in a way that people can digest. You can't expect people to change or to embrace change if you're not giving them a reason to do that. It's such a problem.
If you're only picking out the ones you do well on and just hoping that with all the other noise, nobody will notice that, it doesn't set a good...
If everything's rosy, why would anyone get out of their cars? Why would they sacrifice the convenience of a personal car and get on a bus?
Shall I read out the X from the chair of the Manchester Climate Change Partnership, I think it is worth reading out in response to the A from CDP. It says, the X says, Manchester named a climate action leader for second year in a row, exclamation mark. There are challenges ahead, but it shows that we're on the right path to achieve the city's ambition to become a thriving, green, climate resilient city. I think everything we've just talked about in part one showed that we are not on the right path.
And this is the guy that used to be there presenting to scrutiny about not being on the right path, or alongside the person that we talk about not being on the right path. It's
quite galling.
It's professional gaslighting.
Yeah, I think you can call it greenwash as well, can't you? You know, so I was just having a look at the CDP's A list. There's 939 cities that submit information, and 119, so it's around 13%, got a list. So what that means is you can possibly call yourself a leader of cities.
Yet again,
yeah. But I think some of the flaw of this is to do with what questions they're asking and how they're scoring. So, you know, if you don't submit information, you won't get a score. So it doesn't matter what you're doing. If you don't necessarily sign up to be part of this group, you won't necessarily get that. But, you know, Blackburn are on the A list. So Birmingham and Brighton and a load of others. So, like, you know, but it's a global cities list. It's not necessarily just the UK. So, yeah, I think you obviously use that to say that, you know, to celebrate something. And they want to have positive comms, obviously, rather than they have to, you know, they feel like they've got to say something rather than we scored 28 out of however many hundred and something local authorities, single tier local authorities, which will be probably not such a celebration in the same way of we're on the right path.
So we'll pull together the links to, if we can get it for CDP, great, but definitely to the CEUK report and the scorecard, and we'll put it in the show notes.
It's a good thing for show notes. We have show notes because the CEUK data, we should say, is there's a lot there. It is quite good to play around with, but it's difficult to summarise beyond the trends that we've said here. I do just have a question for you both about, I think the CUK data, is it going to make any difference? I think it's an interesting exercise. They really improved it. Is it going to achieve anything?
At a national level, it's definitely getting into national media. If you take it in the view of those councils that are doing something, not enough, but doing something, they may or may not be affected by this. But increasingly, those that aren't doing anything, who don't have a science-based target, for example, in the last round, they, I think, are going to be increasingly isolated and galvanised by taking this view of almost pitting councils against each other. But it's an important thing to note that this isn't a competition. This isn't a competition. One council cannot win this for everyone. We all cross that line, or we all lose.
Good point. And they do present it as, even though it is ranked, as more of a tool for both activists and councils rather than just a league table, even though they know that by giving it a ranking and a score, it will get some eyeballs on it.
Yeah, the ranking is the reason councils and media talk about it, but the data underneath and the information underneath is more useful to organisations like us,
yeah,
and to councils themselves, who have an open enough mind to want to embrace it and change with it.
If they want to improve the score, that's the thing, isn't it? Is there a commitment to actually look at some of the information contained within it and think about whether they should be doing more?
What would be interesting, and I don't know if this data is available, but there's a process of due diligence and a right of reply for councils. So the scorecards, they'll go through and they'll answer the questions, they'll review the Freedom of Information requests, they'll review the websites, and they'll fill out the scores. Councils then get a chance to look at their own and feedback and say, I think you've got something wrong. I think you've missed some information that we published or whatever to try and. So it would be interesting to see of the ones that are really not doing well, did they reply? Because you can't very well critique and say, you know, we don't see this as important if you took the time to try and correct your score.
Some of those that might not reply might also have fewer resources, right? A long time ago, I worked on this, had a summer job where I was doing a similar methodology for something called the Green League, which was run by something called People and Planet. And we found that the organisations that didn't write back probably just didn't have someone that they could put on the case for writing back.
So yeah, those ones, it's quite interesting. The famous Stockton-on-Tees is second lowest. Thurrock in Essex is the lowest council. It would be interesting to see, again, which councils and maybe what resources they have to actually respond to some of this stuff.
I can say I'm allowed to describe what was talked about on the advisory group. I'm not allowed to attribute what was said by who said it. Chatham House rule.
The real meaning of Chatham House rules.
Because it's a single rule. It's not multiple rules. It's that
is the rule.
But yeah, why? What's the other interpretation of?
People think the Chatham House rule is you can't talk about it at all.
That's handy.
Yeah.
That's the Vegas rule, surely.
It's the Vegas rule.
That's the Chatham House Casino in Vegas.
Okay. So we will absolutely try and surface as much of this information if you're interested in the show notes. What I would say is just to summarise, no council is doing enough. Manchester likes to claim that leadership role and they will claim whatever statistic help support that, but we've got other evidence to suggest that it is not as leading as it likes to think.
Put away the party poppers for now.
Look to Leeds.
Yeah.
And there becomes a gap, an even bigger gap, a chasm between the rhetoric and the reality, which we are going to have to face into as our carbon budget literally evaporates in front of our eyes. Anything else to add on Climate Emergency UK before we move on?
No, that's it.
No, I think, you know, there's a lot of work that's gone into this, so well done.
Well done for the people that pulled it together, yeah.
Yeah, they are not a big group. They have got support from a lot of additional volunteers and they've got some money. They can have a salaried wage to do this, but yeah, I am impressed with the people and their intent, always qualifying it by it is imperfect. There is no perfect way of monitoring all of these councils, except perhaps by, you know, a government, if they chose to prioritise this.
For example.
Okay, moving on to things that are on our mind. And I'm very happy to defer to either of you if there's something you want to get off your chest. But I've definitely got something that I've...
Well, you trailed your little tidbit of something that you've been reading about and it sounded interesting. So tell us more.
Sure. Okay. This is something which I listened to a podcast last year and I think my mind was blown, but then I got on with life and didn't revisit it. And I've since listened to the same podcast again and another one. So this is a podcast called Accidental Gods, hosted by my favourite author, possibly in the world, in my entire life.
That's a big statement.
Yeah, Manda Scott has done... I've got many, many of her books, not up here.
Well, I could see Chaucer, and I didn't think it was going to be him on the podcast.
I always, you're looking at the shelf, the bookshelf there that's got the Riverside Chaucer and two anthologies of Norton anthologies of English literature.
Is that your uni shelf?
Yeah, it's my uni shelf. That's my show off shelf. That this is the guest bedroom, so I want everyone to know that I'm incredibly well read.
You're an English graduate, by any chance?
I've got a friend who used to visit and would always look to his right on the sofa and would see the Riverside Chaucer. So he's quite sad that he doesn't see it nowadays, but it's up in the bedroom instead. Slight tangent there. But Manda Scott, my favourite author, and she has, for the last few years, been hosting Accidental Gods podcast, which is fascinating, but I am so behind on listening to them. So this was one that I listened to last summer, an interview with Dr. Simon Michaud, who's a physicist and geologist with a wealth of experience, and over the last couple of years has been publishing analysis on the green transition and the problems where they exist in the supply chain and some of the underlying plans, assumptions and modelling. And particularly this one was around all of the supply chain issues with those batteries that will be needed in everything from electric vehicles through to all of the other solutions that are going to help us with the green transition.
It's not just lithium.
It's
copper, it's nickel, yeah. It's cobalt.
So let's get into those. So this was also, so I listened to the latest episode of the G&D Media podcast. That was the 8th of Jan. The Mineral Politics of the Just Transitions with Thea Riofrancos. And all of it was interesting. I would recommend listening to both. But really, the way the data was presented in the Accidental Gods podcast has just... it blew my mind, and I think it's something we need to dig into much deeper. But I just want to clearly credit, and I would say, what the data I'm going to give you will possibly blow your mind. But please, I recommend go and listen to the entire podcast. It's an hour and a half long. It's a lot, and it's one of two.
This is like more than a plug. This is like.
But it talks about this sort of stuff in such an interesting way that I hadn't heard before. But yeah, let's get into it. So the summary of, if you think about the green transition, and we think in Manchester, particularly that transport issue and the migration away from internal combustion engine to EVs, and how we talk about getting rid of diesel-powered buses and get them electric as well. And how important that is to the whole idea of decreasing our carbon emissions. We need batteries. We need battery power, and we need it as quickly as possible. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah. See, when we're, rather than burning stuff, yes.
Yes.
So Simon Michaud's research, I think he published it in 2021, he looked at the production rates of certain minerals required in the green transition, looked at pre-pandemic data from 2019 and gave an optimistic view of how much we can mine for each mineral. So if 2019 was a good year for mining, then the pandemic happened and so we don't use data since then. He then looked at all these different minerals and said how many years at 2019 levels would be needed to meet the green transition requirements. So we've got copper, we've got lithium, we've got nickel, we've got cobalt, and a new one on me, germanium, which is needed for solid-state batteries. So how many of 2019 level years would be needed to produce the amount of copper we need for the green transition? And the answer was 195 years.
Wow. Okay, I thought I was going to go with 50 or something.
Yeah, I was going around 60, yeah.
Well, let's go for guesses for the others.
Oh, I'm going to be way off.
How many years of lithium at 2019 levels do you think we would need to power the green transition?
I'm going to go higher than 195. So I'm going to go.
If that was, that's what
300.
You've got 300?
180.
180.
That's just a nice number to say.
The answer was 10,528.
We're in different orders of magnitude away. Wow. Okay.
Nickel. Now, I don't know how what proportions and what types of batteries these need, but nickel, how many would you guess for nickel?
I'm now officially useless at guessing.
I should have done these in a different
order. No. It's interesting because it shows we're off. We're so far off.
I'm going somewhere between, like, lithium and copper.
6,000.
So, Yeah, between is right. It's 413. So we're back down to the hundreds.
Centuries rather than millennia.
Cobalt.
It mainly comes from like only a few countries. Mm. I'm going to say millennia levels. Mm. I'm going for like 5,000.
Okay.
2,000.
Yeah, it's 1,790.
Well done.
So Chloe's closest. And the last one is a very obscure one. And it's skewed slightly because it's needed in solid state batteries, but I think we mine very little of it at the moment. But it is needed as part of that transition. Do you want to have a guess or shall I just come out with a number?
Hit us with it.
Yeah, I think just hit. I think it's going to be several, like 100 millennia. Yeah.
Our minds are all
29,113 years at 2019 levels.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what the obvious thing you would say is, let's get a bit of boosterism in here. Well, we're going to start mining a lot more than we used to mine in 2019. You know, we're going to ratchet that up because of, you know, net zero.
Those are like, you're singing in the ears of Anglo-American and, you know, what's the name of the other, like, is it Macquarie?
Macquarie, yeah.
What's the, there's a few other mining companies.
That's an Australian company, isn't
yeah,
it?
Macquarie, yeah. They're thinking that. And the, yeah. Rio Tinto, that's
Rio
the other
Tinto,
one.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's harmony to the ears of those companies, aren't they? Give us more money. We need more holes in the ground.
More holes in the ground. Now, some of those, like particularly the lithium, the nickel, the cobalt, well, I mean, all of them, I'm not a mining expert, but are we really thinking that there are vast concentrated deposits that we haven't tapped yet that are going to suddenly be okay to tap into with minimum disruption outside of war zones?
Well, you think about displacing people, displacing nature, all the rest of it, you know, trying to do that in a way that's fair, just and sensitive to the environment as much as mining can be.
And this is where I think we can take a climate emergency Manchester framing of this. If all of these minerals are going to be in such small amounts, how does that change your plans for a reducing transport emissions in the city? We've talked about the charging point strategy for electric vehicles. They're currently using a market-led one, which means everyone in Didsbury gets one put on their driveway and no one else around the city does. Are we actually talking about EVs at all? Or should we be prioritising electric buses and taxis and get away from private car use entirely? Because apparently, I would go further, and I really will hand the mic over to you to get your thoughts on this. I would argue that as far as saying, if you've got a finite resource and you in the middle classes are prioritising your family car, you are doing that at the expense of everyone who can't get on an electric bus. Discuss.
Yeah, I see. Well, you slipped in a very good mining-related pun without even saying anything. Digging into it. Yes, without even realising.
Very proud of that.
Better, less innuendo as well.
Yes, yeah, there wasn't an innuendo one for once.
So let's go with the mining analogies then.
Yeah. But answering your question, like, well, this is the whole, I think it comes down to so many ways of you looking at just transition. Like, our middle class is taking the food or resources out of other people's mouths, lives, homes, all the rest of it. In some way, they probably are, but they can also afford it. And it comes to a case of affordability for so much of this. Should we as a city promote, or, you know, the first thing with all those figures that I think about is clearly that's based on us with certain levels of consumption and usage, whether that's personal car use or whether that's like how much electronic gadgets we have in our home or whatever else it might be. Clearly, we can't take that approach, you know, for those elements, you know, than what we've actually got, because it's just not going to happen. But we do need to heat our homes. We do need to get around to move around. So like there are certain fundamentals that have to be met for people to have like some level of existence that they might be able to hark back to what their lives might look like now. But yeah, that the way we do that is clearly going to have to change. You know, I'm sure we're going to talk about it if you talk to Callum about how much copper goes into getting a heat pump. It's a lot. You know, you need bigger pipes. You know, the amount of metal and you know, elements that go into a heat pump is quite different to what you do for a gas boiler, because you're using physics really to sort of convert electrical power into heat and some refrigerant gases. But to do that, you need to exchange heat that you're getting into the from the environment into heat that's heating your house. So that takes a lot of different technology compared to what we've got right now. So
it's a matter of prioritization. Saying we can't just green our current world and our current lifestyle. We're going to have to choose to do things differently if the resources are scarcer.
Yeah. And how many of the discussions that you hear around electric vehicles actually even talk about the minerals? It's increased a little bit, tiny bit, over the past year, but still very few and still minuscule amounts of those that people are discussing. Don't think about that.
No, because you think about the resilience of that as well, because where are these minerals coming from? So, yeah, are they coming from conflict zones? Mm. You know, like there's definitely more awareness of things like cobalt or the ore called coltan that comes from the Democratic Republic of Congo because, and sort of, I think there's some sort of law in America that sort of bans conflict minerals, so therefore like certain areas you can't get your minerals in from that area, but which makes it more complicated if you're trying to find resource in, or you may have to do some very clever accounting that somehow these minerals disappear from a conflict zone and appear in some sort of other country where it's getting processed into you know, metal or something like that. So
not to mention, how does this become an instigator of conflict? How does this change what these conflicts look like? It speaks to the resources that we already know are going to be involved in conflict in the future. Access to water, just access to clean water.
Yeah, access to these minerals, if they're in high demand because people are transitioning away from fossil fuel into electrification, is going to have a massive effect, you know, and especially if policies are incentivizing that, which they rightly should, but that's just going to drive market demand for those
calls
things.
For invasion.
Because you know, once you're in a conflict zone, you can start to exploit and it starts to create chaos, and you're far more likely to get very hard-nosed capitalists in those systems exploiting those, you know, those people in order to get those minerals, if people need to try to make an existence for themselves, make a living.
Thank you for that. There's so much, I think we need to dig into this so much more.
I think it would be a good focus, even if it's not being talked about particularly at Manchester. We can give it a bit of framing, but let's talk about it again.
Yeah, I think like on the left as well, you know, we're talking about the Green New Deal media, like podcast as well. The just transition is a big thing for them. And at what cost will we transition away from fossil fuels? And if it's, you know, fossil fuels have been exploitative in the way that they have you know, repressed communities, you know, there's evidence of people being killed as activists trying to defend their community, defend their environment. You know, there's nothing to say that this won't happen or is not already happening in countries where these minerals are being extracted. So there has to be, you know, scrutiny and work done to make sure that you're not just displacing fossil fuel exploitation for mineral exploitation when it comes to the just transition away from that.
Yeah, the more we can do to link what is a really difficult thing to get your head around, which is this, because we don't do it, we don't see it in this country, and certainly not in areas of Manchester. So it's something that happens elsewhere in the world. How we link that to the choices and the things we see in front of us in our homes and in our city, I do think, digging into it more deeply and to a point where we can understand, you know, what individual choices can I and should I be making to help try and drive the right future? Hint, it's not going by several EVs to park outside your house.
No, but yeah. But also it's quite interesting that you're saying about what sources of minerals can we, you know, are there magic sources? Like, we haven't even started to look at things like landfill. Like, and they have been, you know, people have been talking about landfill as a source of ore, because there's so many things locked up there now that we haven't really thought about in terms of critical resources. And, you know, there's definitely talk at regional level, maybe UK, around sort of critical minerals, critical resources, and thinking about how to circularise that stuff as well. So you're keeping, once you've got that in systems of consumption or, you know, products, that you get an idea of how much is locked in, you know, like how many mobile phones do you have lying around in drawers? That's gold, and, you know, there's loads of minerals in those, and that's actually ore, essentially, you know, if you recycle those and recover those minerals. That's a huge, like, potential gold mine, literally sitting in people's household drawers.
I may have every mobile phone I've ever owned.
You will not be the worst offender, though, because I bet that you don't own as many, haven't owned as many mobile phones as...
Or laptops.
I looked after a very ropey Fairphone 2 for 7 years before upgrading to my current Fairphone. So, and I will keep that until it is a very ropey Fairphone 4. I should add that my mobile phone company don't pay me for advertising on this podcast. But I'm not averse to the idea, so do get in touch.
They don't pay you yet.
Okay, Chloe, Adam, thank you so much for this January podcast. Let's hope February is what? Warmer? Appropriately warm, not crazy warm.
We now know that it's going to start with Groundhog Day. We just did a bit of fact checking and we've checked that 2nd of February is Groundhog Day. And the 3rd and the 4th and 5th should
be. Every day is Groundhog Day. See you then.
Mm-hmm.
See you then.
Bye-bye.